The following podcast is brought to you by The Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning. My name is Bok Shu. And today I'll be offering my sixth and final talk on the Four Vows, more formally known as the Four Bodhisattva Vows, or in Japanese, the Shigu Seigon Man. The most urgent question surrounding the Four Vows is how to live them. If our recitation of the vows is to be something other than a half-hearted, semi-conscious ritual, we have to actualize them in our lives. This means the vows must enter into our attitudes, habits, and choices, into our behavior. What else do we have as human beings in our attitudes, habits, and choices? Even our so-called bodies are our attitudes, habits, and choices. In our bodies and minds, we must live these vows. How do we do this? In a recent column, Washington Post opinion writer Michael Gerson wrote that part of psychological wholeness and of responsible political leadership is the ability to consider reality from someone else's perspective. I would say that the ability to consider reality from someone else's perspective is what defines our humanity. When we lose that precious ability, we become what? At approximately 1:40 a.m. on Thursday, July 4th, someone did very much lose the ability to consider reality from someone else's perspective. In the Circle K convenience store, located at 6735 West Peoria Avenue in Peoria, Arizona, a 27-year-old Caucasian man killed a 17-year-old boy of African-American descent. Maybe you've never heard of Peoria, Arizona. As recently as 1970, Peoria, which is a town in the greater Phoenix metropolitan area, had a population of only 2,500 people. Today, there are roughly 170,000 inhabitants. 85% are Caucasian. 3% are African American. Less than 1% are Native American, which is a pretty astonishing statistic when you consider that that area was for thousands of years exclusively inhabited by Native American people of the Yavapai, Apache, and other tribal groups. The murdered boy, named Elijah Al-Amin, had been working at a Subway sandwich shop about a mile away. He was saving money to buy a new car, and to that end, he also worked another job at AutoZone. Previously, he had worked at Taco Bell. Let's pause for a moment to consider how this young man might have felt working in these places. So nondescript, and yet so incredibly specific. I cannot imagine how he felt. But I do realize that life is just this way for so many young people taking their first steps into adulthood. Around 11:30 p.m. that night, Elijah left Subway and stopped off at the Circle K before going home to Glendale, which is about 5 miles south. He sat in his car, listening to rap music for quite a while before going inside the store. How many young people are there who sit in cars and parking lots listening to music for quite some time before venturing into a store for some trifle? some trifle that they never imagined might cost them their lives. The rap music that Elijah was playing triggered something in 27-year-old Michael Adams, who then followed Elijah into the Circle K near the soda machine, bathed in fluorescent light. Michael stabbed Elijah in the back and then stabbed him again in the right side of his neck with a pocket knife. 2 days earlier, Michael Adams had been released from prison after serving time for aggravated assault. At the Arizona Department of Corrections La Paz prison in Yuma, Arizona. Yuma is a town on the U.S.-Mexico border, about 200 miles from Phoenix. Michael was transported to Phoenix from prison and dumped on the street. In view of his questionable mental health and subsequent events, the lack of post-release supervision was a great error, to say the least. An inconceivably long chain of events had to unfold in a remarkably precise manner for Michael Adams to find and kill Elijah Al-Amin. What is the ultimate source of that precision? Sitting here in the comfort of the Village Zendo, where we routinely try and fail to execute all manner of things with that kind of precision, it is hard to imagine these events as they unfolded. It is hard to consider the reality of either the victim or the perpetrator. Yet, if we are to fulfill our vows, the four vows, we must consider reality from the perspective of both Elijah and Michael. And what is reality? It is the Circle K parking lot where Elijah Al-Amin listened to rap music and then bled to death face down by the gas pumps. It is the houses where Michael Adams grew up and the prisons where he spent much of his adult life. Parking lots, prisons, convenience stores, strip malls, fast food restaurants. These are places so obscure and so desolate that they might as well be on another planet. And yet, they are indisputably real. They are the theaters where the specific details of our living and dying play out, moment by moment, against a backdrop that is colorless, empty, and silent. When you hear teenager, you form an immediate impression of the word and what it might mean for you. When you hear prison, you immediately think of something scary and intense. Even if you're 100 years old, or even if you haven't ever set foot in a prison, you won't lack for ideas for what these words mean, for what these two things that collided on that night mean to you. But your ideas are not reality. Reality is the direct, immediate experience of something, if even something is appropriate in this context, the direct, immediate experience of something that cannot be adequately described or imagined. What isn't reality? My stories, my opinions, my preferences, my ideas. These are not reality. These are my defenses against reality. My defenses will not stop a knife, nor will they make a sandwich, heal a wound, or buy a car. Even so, I cling to my stories, my opinions. In my opinion, it is very difficult to encounter reality without defenses. Sitting here now, what are your defenses? How are you protecting yourself? And what are you protecting yourself from? Until you look at how and why you protect yourself, you can't even come close to saving one sentient being, let alone all sentient beings. It's the looking that allows the healing and the saving to happen. Defenses are all about protection. And the killer, Michael Adams, thought he was protecting himself from black people. He claims to have been attacked in the past by people who listen to rap music. Hearing Elijah's rap music, Michael Adams felt threatened, and he decided to be, in his words, proactive. Apparently, this meant pursuing a boy with whom he had never exchanged a single word into a store and murdering him there. Having done what he did, he used the victim's race and his music as a defense of his own behavior in a statement to the police. He blamed the victim for his crime. It is easy for us here to point the finger and say how unbelievable Michael Adams is. And yes, what we know about his attitudes, habits, and choices is truly shocking. What Michael did to Elijah Al-Amin is horrifying. But Michael Adams is not unique in blaming other people for his own choices and behavior. In fact, I don't think I've ever met a single person who wasn't prone to blaming other people for their own choices and behavior. And I certainly do it myself. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that it is impossible for one person to make another person feel anything. We can and we will be triggered by others based on our own conditioned behavior. But what we feel in response to whatever or whoever triggers us is our own responsibility. All the more, what we do in response to the feelings that are triggered, that too is very much our own responsibility. Our feelings can never be compelled. Think about it. Have you ever felt something, really felt it, because you wanted to? Because you willed yourself to feel it? It's simply impossible. I defy anyone to succeed at that sort of effort. We always have a choice in how we look at whatever triggers us. And if we respond to it, or whether we respond to it. And we're always responsible for what we feel and what we do in response to these triggers. If we're vowing to save all sentient beings, that means we're vowing to save Michael Adams and Elijah Al-Amin. They can't be left out, can they? We're vowing to save the perpetrator and the victim. We're not separate from either of them, not for a moment. And to consider their perspective on reality, we need to begin to acknowledge that their emotions are present in us. It isn't easy, is it? How can I enter the reality of a teenager working two jobs, dreaming of his girlfriend and a new car, about to enter his final year of high school? How can I enter the reality of another young man who'd racked up dozens of criminal charges before murdering a teenager he'd never laid eyes on before? I'd much rather separate them from them and say, they have nothing to do with me. I think the main reason people want to separate from other things, from things they don't like, is that they confuse not separating with liking. We feel it's easier not to pull away if we like something or approve of it. Whatever we disapprove of or dislike, we want to run from. But liking and disliking are the same. They're both products of our conditioning, and they have nothing to do with separating or not separating. If we're to be rigorous about this practice, if we're to really adhere to our vows and the precepts, we have to look at the mechanism of our liking and disliking and how that mechanism drives our separation and shapes our behavior. If Michael Adams had been following this kind of program, he would have noticed that he felt strongly triggered by rap music. He would have said to himself, "This music is really freaking me out. This kid I've never seen before, who has no idea I even exist and is just sitting in his car listening to music, is really freaking me out, and I want to kill him. I really need to look at that." But no, that was not his program. If Michael Adams had had that program, his daughter wouldn't have to grow up without him, and Elijah Alamein's parents wouldn't have to grow old without a son. Really looking at how our minds work is critical if we want to have any insight into ourselves. This insight gives us some space to make choices instead of just reacting blindly out of habit the way Michael Adams did that night. If we persist in really looking at our minds, we enlarge our capacity for choice in how we respond to a person or a situation. Most people would call that freedom. This isn't, "I'm a Buddhist, and come hell or high water, I'm going to love everyone." This is not what I'm talking about. That's not the idea. This is not a self-improvement project. It's a getting to make more and more choices through my growing self-awareness project. Looking at our responses doesn't mean we have to improve them or reform them or change them. Looking at our responses is looking at our responses, full stop. I don't routinely get to participate in the kind of life or death scenario that played out in that parking lot and in that store between Michael Adams and Elijah Alamein. But the method I'm describing, which one might call the fruit of practice, is operative in any situation, including much more conventional ones. So, I was in the produce section of Whole Foods recently. I was looking at the bananas. And across that aisle, there was a middle-aged couple looking at the apples. And they started to put a bunch of apples in a bag. And as they were doing it, one of the apples fell out of one of their hands and started rolling across the floor in my direction. So this, of course, being a moving object, caught my interest. And it came to rest, and I had to observe what was going to happen next. So I noticed that the woman stood and looked at the apple and pondered the situation for a few moments. Then she simply turned back to the apples on the display and continued picking from there with her partner. So she left the apple on the floor. And I didn't like that. That didn't sit well with me. It seemed like an abdication of responsibility. It seemed a little arrogant. It seemed a little wasteful. So I had a whole cascading stream of thoughts, ideas, judgments, just like that. So the point is not to stop those. The point is to be with them, to really be with them, to really watch what is happening in our minds moment by moment, not just on the cushion, in the produce aisle, in the Circle K, moment by moment, watching. So I had a choice. I had a lot of choices. I could have walked away. I could have started screaming. I could have gotten a manager, and so on and so forth. So what I decided to do was I decided to pick up the apple and just put it back. And that's what I did. I put it back where it belonged, without saying a word, without making eye contact, without making a fuss. I just picked it up and put it back. And as I was leaving the area, I noticed that the woman started to whisper to her partner. She'd obviously noticed what I'd done. And she was having a response to my response to her leaving the apple on the floor. What was her response? I don't know. I couldn't hear what she was saying. I wasn't looking at them directly, so I couldn't gauge her expression. But this is what it's like in real life. We have lots of situations and lots of people that we can respond to in lots of different ways. And we can take a really detailed interest in how we react to these things. And we can not react to them. Most importantly, that's the best, is when you really just don't react to them. Because what do we really know about what's right and what's wrong? I mean, you know, was it right for me to put the apple back? What if somebody else picked it up and didn't know it had been all over the floor? That probably wouldn't have been so great for them. So, you know, I just did what I did, not knowing if it was right or wrong. But I looked at it as I did it. I really thought about my choices, just as she really thought about whether she was going to pick it up or not. So in that very ordinary encounter in the grocery store, all the elements of Michael's encounter with Elijah were operative. At each moment, that couple and I balanced on the knife edge of possibility, with only our self-awareness and our ability to choose making the difference between murder and transcendence. Recognizing that I am not separate from all that is, this is the precept of non-killing. Transforming suffering into wisdom, this is the precept of not indulging in anger. The dharmas are boundless. I vow to master them. Each moment is holy ours. And the way each moment leads to the next moment is completely up to each of us. I'd like to close by quoting Victor Hugo's essay on William Shakespeare, because I think it really connects to Elijah, to Michael, and to each of us in each moment of our lives. The expanse of the possible is in some sort under your eyes. The dream that you have within yourself, you discover beyond yourself. All is indistinct. Confused white shadows are moving. Are they souls? In the deeps of space, there are passings of vague archangels. Will they one day be men? Grasping your head between your hands, you strive to see and to know. You are at the window opening into the unknown. On all sides, the deep layers of effects and causes, heaped one behind the other, wrap you with mist. A man who meditates not lives in blindness. The man who meditates lives in darkness. The choice between darkness and darkness, that is all we have.